Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast.
As a digital extension of the Ackerman Center, our goal is to teach the past so we can change the future.
In doing so, we address issues related to Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies from diverse perspectives.
Welcome back to our listeners. We're here with Dr. Martin Dean, who has given Michael and Elaine Jaffe lecture this morning at the annual Scholars Conference. And before we get started, we'd like to know a little bit more about you, Dr. Dean, about how you came to this work and how you came to this field.
It's a very long story, so I'll try and keep it fairly short. I did a PhD on late 18th century Austrian history and was fairly comfortable in that field, but I had actually always planned to switch to World War II later on. And then just as I was finishing my PhD, I got a kind of an offer you can't really refuse, which is to work on a government investigation into war crimes organized at that stage by the Home Office in Britain. So that was my first job in war crimes. I then actually had two other jobs as a historian advising different war crimes investigations, one in Australia, and then the last one was at Scotland Yard. So my real work as a historian was to go into the archives and find everything that was relevant or useful to support prosecutions, mainly in the UK, but also in Australia. And some of the cases I worked on also ended up in German courts as well.
Yeah, you're one of the few people that are probably the only one, actually, that come to think that I know that has on their kind of biography that you work with the Metropolitan Police War Crimes Unit, Scotland Yard. Now, that has a cool ring for a historian to it, doesn't it? But it means, I think, that all along you developed a kind of interest in very detailed archival research and then very detailed research about sites. And then presumably, right or wrong, correct me, I associate that with the work of Scotland Yard of, you know, really minuscule, you know, oriented research, but also very tentative to sites and kind of what remains in them as well.
It's a kind of micro history. That's exactly right. And sometimes my instructions were literally to find everything you can about this small village or town. You could spend weeks in German archives going through huge prosecution cases, just looking for the name of a village or the names of one or two officials you were looking for. So sometimes you would be reading hundreds of pages, just looking for a very, very detailed piece of information. But what I did enjoy, especially at Scotland Yard, was kind of developing cases as well. So in some ways, I was the person that got to decide, well, does this look like an interesting case or is there just really nothing there? Because if I found a lot of information in the archives that might lead towards a particular individual, then that would then mean the detectives go to that town or village and start interviewing the locals to develop the case further. So I was kind of setting some of those cases off on their later trajectory.
Very interesting. But, you know, and then in other ways, though, I think our mind, we always assume kind of attempt to make a case with something where we are really in the position of making really clear-cut cases. But I think a lot of your work really focused on a landscape of the Holocaust, meaning the Ukraine, where many of the lines, you know, ended up being far more complicated or more blurred than we often say between the Ukrainians, the different ethnicities, Jews, Germans, and their various kind of degrees of complicity, collaboration, and so on and so forth. So in lots of ways, a very messy landscape. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I was particularly interested in the former Soviet Union, Ukraine, Baltic states, Belarus. Partly that was just where the cases were that I was investigating initially, but it was also kind of a blind spot for German historians that they were reluctant to sort of extend the list of perpetrators at that time, at least. I wanted to focus on German culpability. So there was a gap in the literature. So my first major book on the Holocaust was Collaboration in the Holocaust, which tried to really understand how these units of collaborators were organized. And what I did find was particularly interesting that the local police, the people who went to school with Jews in some places, were the ones who also had to sort of round them up and escort them to the killing sites. In some cases, they also pulled the trigger. So there was this kind of intimacy in that relationship, which you don't get so much in a common understanding of the Holocaust, say, where it's people being put on a train and taken somewhere else to be killed, where there's this sort of distance between where they grew up and where it actually ends.
Yes, you mentioned about your work when you were with Scotland Yard and having to gather up as much information as you possibly can when you're researching something. For you, when you're encountering histories that are incomplete or cases where the information is lacking, is that a problem? Does that present particular type of issue since what you're meant to do is find as much as you can? Or how does that work?
Well, that's an interesting part of my work at Scotland Yard, certainly, that there were many cases where we sort of had the instinct or the feeling that this person was probably to some extent culpable or guilty, but we could only really focus on those cases where there was strong evidence. So the legal process does sort of focus you, and you're frustrated by that, but at the same time, there's no point bringing a case if it's just going to get thrown out by the lawyers as soon as it gets to court. So you have to focus on what can get done. And that's something I sort of learned very quickly. Actually switched from what you might see as the more glamorous cases, the Einsatzgruppen, which moved from village to village one day to the next. It was very hard to get witnesses to sort of put those people at the scene of the crime, and we were literally looking for eyewitnesses, someone who saw this person pull the trigger. If we worked in a small village or even a medium-sized town, so some of the shtetl in Belarus, then, as I say, these people went to school with the people we were, the Jewish victims, and so there were still survivors who remembered what they did. Often, actually, in Belarus, people would say, well, he committed all these other crimes against non-Jews. Why are you not interested in that? And we did investigate that to some extent, but of course, the main focus was on Holocaust crimes.
We're stuck now on you and the Scotland Yard. I mean, it's too good of a story to abandon, but let me just extend this just a little bit further. I was struck today in your presentation the ways by which you made use of aerial photos. And I think you, in two or three cases, you used aerial photos of various camps, but your observations were almost had a bit of a forensic quality of sorts, because I think in the one case, it was Sachsenhausen, if I remember this correctly, the kind of bird's eye view very quickly allowed you to establish actually a bigger truth. And that was the kind of level of knowledge that this was not removed or anything from average Germans, but in lots of ways really surrounded by residential areas. So I thought, this is usually, we take a lot of time to make that argument, but an aerial photo like the one that you used and the way in which you used it, make that very quickly. And then I think the other one was, if I remember, this was a barrack, the outlines of a barrack, you know, and which then allowed you to make very quick assumptions about this having been part of the 1005 action, right? The kind of attempt to conceal any kind of remnants of evidence of sorts. Is that part of a method that you like to employ, this kind of forensic reading of aerial photos?
To be honest, I've only been employing aerial photographs the last 3 or 4 years, so it was something very specific that we decided to do at Babyn Yar, because that was kind of the missing piece of the puzzle. It could link the ground photographs with the narrative of the victims, and it actually proved very effective there. There have been some other sites which have the same sort of issues, that it was almost completely changed after the war, so even where you have the witness testimonies, you can't really see what they're talking about on the ground unless you have an aerial photograph from the wartime period. I think another one is at Ponari, near Vilnius, where again there was quite a bit of change to the landscape in the immediate post-war years, so that they've used aerial photographs there to sort of reconstruct the whole scene. And there are other methods people use now which are also more forensic in some ways, like LIDAR. It's been used quite a bit. I worked on a BBC documentary that was published last month, and there they were combining these aerial photographs with some more modern LIDAR research, and also obviously some witness testimony to try and tell the story. So there are lots of different ways. I obviously, having had this idea of microhistory from Scotland Yard, and applied that in some of my books, that's still a way I like to approach it. But I try to combine it with witness testimony, and not just Jewish testimony, also some for my Babyn Yar project, I use a lot of German witness testimonies, which they don't necessarily remember the details particularly well, but there are just little pieces here and there which I can then cross-reference with the other sources to give a much richer narrative.
In your talk that you gave this morning, and kind of in the greater context of the conference, you talked a bit about this idea of discontinuity. And I think it's really interesting, because when you talk about discontinuity, typically you're looking at it from the perspective, not from the Jewish perspective, but maybe from the political, the economic, you know, the perspective of a more aerial type of view. But you mentioned very briefly, and I kind of wanted to hear more about how this discontinuity would have appeared from the Jewish perspective, because we think, looking back, we can see the patterns that are unfolding, and we understand when, the Nuremberg race laws come out and when the persecutions start, when you have Kristallnacht, it's a clear path that something is, going to go in a catastrophic way. But, obviously they wouldn't have known that at that time. So I just wonder if you could speak more about this idea of discontinuity from the Jewish perspective.
Right. I didn't realize this till quite late on in preparing the presentation, but I had two or three of these quotes where Jewish survivors, or some who didn't even survive, make this kind of comment that this was a turning point in their life or something that they're never going to forget. And it was very often actually the same sort of turning points. Kristallnacht was definitely one. Also, these Jewish prisoners who were taken to Dachau, suddenly they're sort of being wrenched out of their family lives and beaten up, even on the way to concentration camps, made it quite clear to them that nothing was going to be the same again. So that's they're actually saying this is such a total discontinuity. We have to comment on that usually in telling the story afterwards. That's how they recalled it. So I did try to get that. It's a sort of corroboration from the other perspective of some of the main turning points.
But it's an interesting, I was struck again when you mentioned this today, because in other ways, it results ultimately in the release of all these Jewish prisoners, so that you use some number, I think, from 1941 or something like that the total number of Jews being imprisoned and incarcerated is actually, comparatively speaking, low. So in many ways, are we accelerating the kind of harassment and intimidation and incarceration? Are we more at this point into slave labor, right? And into exploiting prisoners for the various industries?
Well, that was actually a major discontinuity in a larger continuity. So I was focusing on how the concentration camps were established in 1933, and then they become the repository for 30,000 Jews in 1938. And then suddenly they're kind of emptied out for this reason that in that period, 39 to 40, the main aim is still trying to drive Jewish emigration. So they literally use the incarceration, the concentration camps, to accelerate emigration by taking the businesses away from these people and getting them to commit to emigrating. And then during the final solution itself, as I was mentioning, most of the Jews are not in concentration camps. They're in forced labor camps and ghettos. Obviously, in Germany, there are a few. There's actually an order, I'm trying to remember the exact date now, it's sometime before 1940, I think it's at the end of 42, to remove all the Jewish prisoners from concentration camps and send them to Auschwitz. That's done kind of in the middle of this period. And then this final order, which I did focus on a bit more, was the one in 1943, where they suddenly decide to close down remaining ghettos and forced labor camps and put those Jews into concentration camps for the simple reason that after the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, they see Jews as
a danger threat.
No longer safe in less secure camps.
Let me, and then I'll hand over again, but one of the kind of interesting questions in my mind is always when we talk about microhistory, then we have that sense that where there's micro, there's macro, right? And it kind of suggests the wholeness that we can kind of scale down again into something small. So it's almost like an accordion that we can kind of make big and make small again. But obviously it doesn't quite work that way. And the evidence that one draws from a particular micro case doesn't always immediately illustrate the big case, but it can also at times contradict that. And I think we struggle with that at times when we look, for example, at Dachau. The evidence that you derive from one particular camp tells a very particular story that somehow is related to the macro history, but it's not that the small pieces, it's not like Legos that they all kind of make up the bigger ones so neatly. Do you come up against this on and off?
Well, I did a very strange thing. I did the Encyclopedia of Ghettos, where I looked at 1,000 ghettos. So I literally have the story of every single ghetto. And you start to see the bigger picture emerging out of that. And the way we broke it down is to do like a regional entry for each of the major regions within the German area of control. And what we found is each region has its own history. So you can sort of get this intermediate regional
scale
pattern, which makes some sense. And actually, there's not as much coordination between the different regional patterns as one would imagine. So this, again, reflects the way the Nazis organized things, that the kind of the regional leader had a lot of control over what happened when and how the pattern develops. So it is particularly problematic with Nazi history that it's not like someone presses a button in Berlin and the same thing happens everywhere else, but it there are delays and different kind of conflicting interests within the polycratic system.
Very interesting.
Okay. My question was about something that you began your presentation with, and something that really struck me was the role of fire. And I hadn't made the connection, you know, the burning of books, the burning of the synagogues, the burning of the concentration camps, you know, crematoriums, all these things, they're involving fire. And I just wondered, what was the significance of that idea, that what compelled you to make that connection, and how significant is that connection, or how significant should we see that connection?
I wouldn't want to overemphasize it. So obviously the main means of killing were poison gas and shooting, mm-hmm. although there is certainly with shooting that does involve some kind of explosion. But it's this metaphor, and it seemed to me that there was an act of staging these, particularly Kristallnacht is where it's performative in a way, and fire has that really sort of compelling thing. People do stand around and watch a fire. And then it struck me then with this final thing, which is so less well known, the Operation 1005, that they really did go to the effort to try and burn most of the corpses of those people who were shot. So I'm just trying to see a continuity that maybe people might have missed before. And I see another link is the way the Nazis, they would have these torchlit processions to try and kind of whip up enthusiasm amongst their own supporters. And this all, especially in the 1930s, you see a number of different things. They also used searchlights to create a cathedral of light at Nuremberg rallies sometimes. So particularly in the dark, they were using these kind of theatrical tricks to emphasize the mass organization and kind of dominance. So it's another version of the Nazi propaganda, but it goes into these sort of performative acts. And then from my knowledge of the ghettos and some of the camps as well, sometimes they literally did burn down the barracks or the ghetto to complete the destruction in some areas particularly where they encountered resistance. So it became a sort of necessary method for them in sort of extreme cases.
As far as you talked about Kristallnacht, I mean, as far as the kind of burning of synagogues are concerned, it is, like you said, it's very public. It's a performative way of, quote unquote, enacting, so to speak, the purity of the Aryan society. But in other ways, it's something that provides a lot more opportunity for complicit participation, all the way down to allowing these fires to go on at the potential risk of neighboring buildings and so on. It's a really extreme measure, because these burning synagogues occur within urban settings. It's not that it's not that the synagogues always are on the outskirts of towns, but they're often right in the middle. So I think it's very extreme of sorts, if one thinks about it. And there are lots of comments about how bystanders were perplexed at the thought that neither police nor the fire department came and nothing was really done to control this somehow of sorts. So there's something really transgressive that's in many ways presumably where one is in 1938, that you have this, through this form of public display, you gain all of a sudden, you kind of cross a threshold of sorts of a form of violence and of transgressive behavior that possibly would have been inconceivable still in 33 on that scale.
Yeah, I think it's certainly before the war, it's about as far as they could go, and they were sort of pushing it there, and it had a lot of negative consequences. So there was also something uncontrolled about it that was damaging to the German economy, mm-hmm. and also creating a lot of friction and even protests overseas. So I think it shows that they really wanted to push this, despite the costs.
Very true. So you've been doing this for a while. Where do you think, if you were to be a student at this point, where would you go? Where do you think are the big questions? I mean, your work has a lot to do with the opening up of new archives, right? There's this outburst of research activity in the 90s that is all about Eastern Europe and the Ukraine and all that. So that's kind of the enabling factors of the what we thought was the end of Cold War and conflicts as we know it, right? But today, where do you think are we in terms of the bigger questions?
I think from my own perspective, what I might like to do in more detail if I find more time and the sort of commitment to it is actually see it much more from the victim's perspective. And these massive archives we now have, the ITS, the Schoer Foundation, they give us a possibility to sort of understand the Holocaust in ways that even the Nazi records can't actually give us the same sort of detail. I learned this a bit with my encyclopedia project, that with the ITS you can trace thousands of victims through a series of camps. You can see what happened to most of the people from a particular place. You can even find out the names of camps that people didn't know existed. And this seems to me to show that there is still plenty of work to be done. And some of it may be kind of small in terms of its overall importance, but I'm always looking for the things that have been sort of missed out or left behind. And these are definitely some of the topics that haven't been completed. I talked about the camps for Mischlinger, for example, which, again, have not really been researched.
No, you brought this up earlier this morning as well, the kind of radicalization that all of a sudden, you know, once enacted in 1933, but then really only implemented in 1944. There's this kind of new policy that employs then the descendants of these mixed families into slave labor, essentially, right, of sorts. And in many German cities, in particular, for clearing of rubbles and things mm-hmm. like that, but on a large scale.
There is an interesting link to the conference there, that quite a few of these people were Christian, so many of them had converted.
Right.
Some of them were even priests. And it was also actually a place where quite a bit of resistance was planned. Some of these people were planning for what to do once Nazi Germany was defeated.
But also, obviously, again, now very much one that makes everything even more visible to the average German, because many of these workers, they are at night concentrated in wherever they're staying. And then, you know, I know from my hometown in Hamburg, in the morning, they're marched out to the places where they work, and then they're returning. So, at this point, I mean, it couldn't be any more visible to anyone, really, what's happening. It's quite literally happening in front of your very own eyes. And that brings us back again to all these missing details that this meticulous research on the ghettos and then also later the camps has revealed, that a camp like Dachau, I think, was the center of about 100 sub-camps. So that the sheer number of camps, you know, in total is far greater than we ever probably had imagined, because we were drawn always to the major one.
Yeah, there's a kind of reversal in the functions of concentration camps. They become like a central administration for all these sub-camps, and they're constantly moving prisoners around from one labor detachment to the other. Mm-hmm. And these are obviously, a lot of them are in factories and places where, and this does to some extent save a few Jewish lives, because the sort of work they're doing is quite important for the war industry. So not all supervisors are going to beat their prisoners to death. And they're also amongst other prisoners in the concentration camps in a way they're not in the ghettos or forced labor camps for Jews.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Martin. This has been a great pleasure for us, learning a little bit more. We had the double pleasure of listening to you earlier this morning when you delivered the Jaffe lecture, and now again when you joined us here for our podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is hosted by a team of dedicated faculty and research assistants at the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies. You can learn more about our work and find upcoming events at our website, www.ackerman.utdallas.edu.